and welcome to Midnight Harmony. We're so glad you joined us tonight and excited that you're a part of our program. We do many, many different aspects on this program, from interviews with wonderful people and talking about different lives and how courage and hope and joy have changed people's lives over the years. And tonight we're going to do something just a little different. We're going to read from a book. It's a book that I wrote. It's called My Name is Nobody. And we're going to read chapter one, entitled Prince Fahad. It was the fall of 1980. The comic strip The Far Side debuts in newspapers worldwide. The United States Olympic hockey team defeats the Soviet Union in the medal round of the Winter Olympics in the Miracle on Ice. Voyager 1 probe confirms the existence of Janus, a moon of Saturn. President Jimmy Carter announces the United States will boycott the Summer Olympics in Moscow. Operation Eagle Claw, a commando mission in Iran to rescue American embassy hostages, is aborted after mechanical problems ground the rescue helicopters. 8 United States troops are killed in a mid-air collision during the failed operation. Comedian Richard Pryor is badly burned while trying to freebase cocaine. Former California governor and actor Ronald Reagan is nominated for U.S. president at the Republican National Convention in Detroit, Michigan. Mount St. Helens erupts in Washington, killing 57 and causing $3 billion in damages. A fire at the MGM Grand Hotel and Casino on the Las Vegas Strip kills 85 people. John Lennon is shot and killed. Kristen Bell, Michelle Williams, Nick Swisher, Venus Williams, Jake Grover are born, and Dorothy Stratton, Steve McQueen, and Colonel Sanders died. I was 18 years old, 1 year behind my peers as a junior in high school. Employment was a night job at Denver's premier French dining establishment, Chateau Pyrenees. Just a year prior, I had finished a restaurant arts course at Warren Occupational Tech Center, where I'd fallen in love with my instructor and the art of cooking. Culinary fascination won my heart, and I left the unsuspecting instructor to follow my gastronomical desires. My father landed me the job at Chateau Pyrenees, not in the kitchen, but as a parking valet. In those days, a parking valet was a wonderful job and well-respected. It required finesse and courtesy, and the rich and famous were always willing to compensate a kind touch of respect and etiquette. Prior to each night's opening, a table was set for the staff. After being seated and offered a beverage, the chef would appear from the kitchen with his staff and walk us through the night's specials and offerings. His staff would then proceed to serve each staff member a dish with many of the specialties carefully plated and garnished. I was in heaven. Dining with the staff was fun and always interesting, as I was the youngest staff member. Treated with kindness and part of the conversation, it was as though perhaps I too had achieved a certain level of social status. The warm drinks and prodigious feast was short-lived, as guests would be arriving soon. Pulling my long black wool overcoat onto my shoulders, lifting the collar over my ears, I departed the warmth of the establishment and made my way onto my turf for the night, the driveway. Nights on the driveway of the chateau were lonely. There were no heaters to stand beneath to stay warm. Jumping up and down or pacing back and forth was the only source of heat. The cold wind blew in from the northwest across the open landscape. In 1980, the city of Denver had not grown immensely as it is now, and the chateau sat exposed to the elements. The first car in each evening was Mr. Perlman's, a Cadillac, or perhaps it was a Lincoln Continental. Regardless, it was luxurious, clean, and warm. Mr. Perlman's occupation was never revealed to me, but my father knew of him well, and everyone in the establishment seemed to hold him with great esteem. As I recall, he always was alone, never with a Mrs. Perlman or mistress or date, as many of the guests seemed to bring with them. I made my way around the vehicle, careful not to slip on the ice, and opened the driver's door. "Good evening, Mr. Perlman. Welcome to Chateau Pyrenees." Guests never knew the delight I had in opening their doors. Not so much to serve them, but to feel the warmth of the car spill out onto my feet and ankles. They could take as much time exiting as they liked. Mr. Perlman slid off the leather seat, pulling his cream-colored overcoat tightly around his body. Then he would speak as he had done many times before. "Young man, if my car is parked here when I finish my dinner and prepare to leave, your tip will be $15. If you have to run and get it, and I have to wait, your tip will be $5. It's entirely up to you." Mr. Perlman would smile a friendly smile, cautiously maneuver across the icy drive and make his way up the steps and into the establishment where piano music could now be heard playing. The door closed, and it was quiet once again. Slipping onto the leather seats, I pulled the door shut and sat for a moment, warming my mittened fingers on the defrost vents. Mr. Perlman's car was clean, refreshing. Most cars were, but his seemed especially clean, and I was in no hurry to escape the tranquility it brought my senses. A moment's pause, and I slipped the shifter into reverse. Backing up 20 feet, I shifted back into drive and pulled into a vacant space adjacent to where I had just been, under the large canopy roof. Regretfully exiting the yacht-like cruiser, I slid across the driveway, up the steps, and secured Mr. Perlman's keys into the key box. There was no need for tickets. Chateau Pyrenees was a dining establishment for the wealthy, whom I had come to know personally. If I couldn't remember which car went with a certain guest, it was only a matter of asking what car they drove. The Ferrari, the Rolls, or the Lamborghini. It wasn't difficult to find one's car unless, of course, there were two or three Ferraris on the property that night. "Which color is your Ferrari?" would suffice, and I would be off sliding across the black pavement, eager for even a moment inside a car, long enough to let the shivering taper off momentarily. The next car to arrive under the dimly lit canopy was the owner. He would stop his car, but didn't always wait for me to open his door. Tonight he did. "Good evening," I would say. "Good evening, I see Mr. Perlman has arrived," he would utter with a slight disdain, not for the man himself, but for the fact that it was Mr. Perlman's car that was parked in the owner's privately reserved spot. A sign in front of Mr. Perlman's car even read, "Reserved for owner." "My apologies, sir." He grinned, surveyed the parking lot, the red carpet leading up the steps, the lights, anything that had to do with ambiance. Piano music again slipped out the door for a brief moment, then he was gone for the evening. It wasn't the first time Perlman had stolen the owner's parking place, and it certainly wouldn't be the last. I took care, however, to park the owner's car out of the way of guests and still a good portion of it under the canopy. Now the rush was on. An entourage of luxury vehicles, cavalier men, and gorgeous narcissist dames began. The overcoat was off, and suit and jacket sufficed, keeping me warm as I parked the first Rolls and jogged back to the canopy for the second. A Cadillac pulled in next, followed by a Lincoln. There was space for two cars side by side beneath the canopy, but I had to move fast, opening doors of one, greeting the clients between short breaths, then opening the doors of the second, while lights of yet a third and fourth car appeared on the drive. Now there was no time nor need to warm myself on the leather seats, and no time to admire the interiors. The next 2 hours would be a frantic pace of shuffling cars. As the night wore on, my feet finally succumbed to the cold and grew numb. No amount of running or jogging in place worked. I couldn't feel my toes enough to wiggle them and couldn't fit an extra pair of socks into the already tightly fitted leather patent shoes. Climbing the stairs, I would huddle close to the stone wall, out of the way of the large wooden swinging door. An occasional gust of wind would find my secret wallow, stealing any warmth I had managed to store up since the last gust, as endless shivers racked my scrawny 5'10" frame. Hands stuffed deep inside my overcoat pockets, my head buried inside the collar, I would let myself drift off to sleep just enough to try and ward off the bitter cold. From inside, I could hear the elegant piano and an occasional laugh or clink of a glass. It was subtle, but enough to draw me into the warmth of the dining room. The chateau was elegant, right out of a 40s-style movie. Walking up the stairs from outdoors where I had just greeted you and your guests, clients would glide through the double wooden doors and upon entering be greeted by another set of steps leading down into the dining area. From this elevated platform, you would first be greeted by the host dressed in a smart black tux. Most likely he knew you by name and would greet each of your guests by name. Coats were taken to the coat closet, and from this vantage point you could see what other esteemed colleagues or high society guests had ventured out on this winter night. A large crystal chandelier graced the center of the dining room, providing light, but not too much, over the center of the room. Against the walls were plush, half-round booths with high backs, enough for six to sit comfortably and all retain a back-to-the-wall sense of security. The host would invite you down the steps and to your white-spread linen table, cloth napkins, elegant silverware, glassware, candle lighting. Nothing was spared. No one was without. Waiters, sommelier, the chef, the host, and often the owner would all greet you and your guests at some point during your meal of lavish cordon bleu, steak au poivre, caviar, Caesar salad prepared tableside, and a $500 Chateau Mouton Rothschild from the Pauillac region in France. My belly growled me awake from my indoor dream where I had been enjoying all the frivolities of the wealthy. A rather nasty gust of wind stung my cheeks and rattled the valet signpost on the drive. Lights flashed across the parking area as a vehicle roared into the drive. Prying my stiff body from the stone wall, I shook myself awake, pasted a smile on my lips, and skipped down the steps onto the driveway to greet my next guest. Prince Fahad never arrived early in the evening, but always around 9 o'clock or a bit after. He never drove the same car, and a different dame would always emerge from the passenger seat. "Good evening. Welcome to Chateau Pyrenees." The dames rarely replied with a hello or any courteous greeting, but the prince himself was always very kind. "Hello, my friend. How have you been?" "Cold. Very cold. So we're headed indoors quickly. Please be careful with my car." "Yes, sir." The prince never wore an overcoat, only the jacket that accompanied his classy fitting suit. The dames wore furs, long dresses with high side cuts, and plenty of jewelry. I watched them climb the stairs together, whispering and giggling. As the doors opened, a glimpse of the staff snapping to attention was a reminder that tonight, the cold and long hours, would have a payoff. I slipped into the Ferrari, checked the rearview mirror to ensure no one else was arriving, familiarized myself with the dials and controls, blasted the heater to full, and pulled shut the door. Bliss. Silence. Essence. What the dame had been wearing was always a distraction for a young 19-year-old with fantasies of what was beneath all the fine clothing. But the perfume essence in the air as I sat in the car was now a different distraction. I shifted the car into gear and slowly drove down the long drive to the parking area. Taking my time, I generally parked the prince's car far from the other vehicles, backing it into its place so I could still see the front drive should another guest arrive. Shutting off the lights, I would sit inside listening to the rumble of the engine, letting the heat pour across my numb toes and ankles, taking deep breaths again and again, the perfume filling my lungs and soul. A kind of sadness would overcome me, a comparison of who I was and who the prince was, what he had, who he had. He could have anyone and in fact did, Week after week, a new girl, blonde, brunette, red Ferrari, yellow Ferrari, nothing was outside his grasp or reach. To some degree, I would benefit, as would all the staff at the chateau tonight. The prince was generous and made certain each waiter, host, and anyone that even came close to making an effort to serve him would be tipped well. As valet, I could always count on $100 and no less. It wasn't a shoddy $100 exchange either. The prince would kindly shake my hand, offer me the $100, and thank me for the time and for the effort before climbing into the car. It wasn't just a few bills stuffed into my hand out of obligation, but a kind gesture of appreciation. King Solomon was the richest and wisest man that ever lived. So it says in 1 Kings 10:23. So King Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom. Power and money is a lure we have all chased at some point in our swim for survival. Willingly, we would bite the sharp barb hook if we could first catch it and secondly survive being landed on shore. But what would we do with it once we had it? At the age of 19, I had no idea who Prince Fahad was, nor his background, employment, investments, or his future for that matter. I only knew he was kind, seemingly generous, but though looking back it was less likely generosity and more likely flash. But at 19, flash looked good. High society, fast cars, and classy dames seen by appearance a very good idea. What was the catch? Was there one? Could I someday be like the prince? Certainly I didn't have any royal blood, or maybe I did. I was, after all, adopted at a very young age of 6 months. Why the burning desire to be like the prince? Solomon had 700 wives and princesses and 300 concubines, 1 Kings 11:3 tells us. If he was having sex with each one, that would be more than 2 one-night stands every single night over the course of a year. As a 19-year-old with an overload of hormones and testosterone, that seemed not only possible but desirable. Yet herein lies the problem. That same verse tells us that Solomon's wives turned away his heart. From what? From the Lord. I became a Christian at the age of 19 and was excited about the transformation that was taking place in my mind. There was a true spirit of change in my heart and an attitude of hope in my mind. I found myself desiring good things, hopeful things, and believing I could do good in the world and for God. This is a great dilemma for a young man striving to figure out next steps in life. The value of things and management of money, working 40 hours a week at a premier dining establishment for the rich and famous and gorgeous and classy. Looking back over my life, I can't say I still don't want or desire that wealth. But even at the age of 19, I somehow knew that acquiring that kind of wealth was not possible without sacrificing something. I couldn't pinpoint what it was, but there had to be something people were giving up to live the lives they flaunted at the chateau. Even Solomon, the wisest man in the world ever to be, gave up something. Scripture tells us that in the end of his life he went mad, turned away from God, and that God's anger was kindled against him. I smiled as I opened the door for the prince, and he kindly shook my hand and placed a $100 bill in my other. Thank you. It was a wonderful night. Thank you, sir. Have a great evening. The prince was seated into the warm Ferrari, which I had purposefully started long before he exited the chateau. Before the door would close, I would catch one last glimpse at the long legs in the passenger seat. I don't think he ever caught me staring, but I don't think he would have minded either. I closed the door and waved as he shifted into gear and drove out into the night. It was near 12. All the other guests were long gone. The piano was silent as the wood door opened and the host stepped outside and down the steps, two glasses of Cavassier in hand. Taking one of the glasses, we clinked the rims together and drank of the sweet, warm, medicinal liquor. Standing quietly, we grinned at one another, knowingly, as though we had somehow conned the prince into giving us larger-than-normal tips. My $100 was small in comparison to the inside staff and hosts, which would have doubled, tripled, and in some cases quadrupled that amount. The engine of the Ferrari could be heard as it spun onto Interstate 25. From where we stood, we could see the car speed north towards the city, out of sight. The warm liquor had done its trick. The shivers subsided, even my toe seemed to have thawed slightly. I thanked the host and handed him my empty glass. Gliding back up the stairs, he and the other staff members would embrace another glass or two, but I wasn't interested in alcohol outside of that one sip to warm my cavities. It was soothing and always seemed enough. Stepping out from under the canopy, I walked to my cold car sitting in the darkness of the back lot, looked up at the stars, and thoughts went through my mind, repeating themselves night after night. Would I ever amount to something more? Would I ever attain to something greater? Or had my life and all others been sorted and stamped at the start of creation? A king, a prince, and a valet. You're listening to Midnight Harmony, a production of Help World Tour. Help World Tour is a ministry that travels the world and helps people make Jesus a part of their story. You can read more about their story, their ministry, and their tent revivals and their movie at www.helpwt.com. The movie Take Your Dream is an award-winning film about a father and his two sons that swam Australia's longest river to inspire a nation. It's a fantastic story, and you can rent it on Amazon Prime. Again, it's entitled Take Your Dream. I'm so glad you joined tonight. I hope that story settles into your craw. You take just a little bit of time and reflect on your own life, on the people that you've met and the places that you've been where it sometimes seems others have great, great success. But you may be feeling as though your success is nowhere close financially and nowhere close as the world might call success. But I would encourage you to draw close to the Lord and ask Him to reveal to you His goodness, His grace, His mercy, and most of all, the many, many blessings that He has poured out upon your life. There's nothing greater than drawing close to the Lord and realizing our real success is the story that we each carry, the story of Jesus in our hearts. I hope that's your story. If not, we'd sure love to guide you that direction. We'd love for you to take time to make Jesus a part of your story and know that your heart is soft and your success is secured for eternity because of your love for Jesus and His love for you. You can always go to our website, and tell us your story. Again, that is www.helpwt.com/yourstory, and tell us a little bit about who you are. I'm always interested in what you think of our program. You can write to me at inquiry@helpwt.com. My name again is E.W. Helmick. Thank you for joining tonight. We have some more stories coming up from the book, My Name is Nobody. Until next time, a peaceful good night.